One of the emotions that I was sitting with during the meditation happened to be grief, because I got word on Saturday night that my childhood best friend's father passed away. And I hadn't seen the parents in, a number of years, just life. Everything going on, and they were on the East Coast in New York City. But my friend's dad was a very special person to me, an important person in my life, and only in his passing is it kind of clarified for me a little bit. I was 13 years old when my own father passed away, and from my childhood, basically age 4 years old, with a little bit of blips, but 4 years old until finishing high school, I sort of lived with, a lot of the time with my friend's family. It was there every weekend, and so I and my friend's father, he was 85, and he had been ill a little bit. I mean, he had a bladder infection that then became sepsis, so that's very serious. But the thing is, he had recovered from the sepsis, and he was in a kind of rehab, and he had been a little bit in a delirium and not really himself. And then about 2 weeks ago, he really came back. And he was his old self. He remember, he could recognize people. He, just really felt like Bernie was back. And then quite suddenly, they got a phone call that saying that he had passed. So they don't really know. They're assuming it was a heart attack or something, but they don't really know. But one of the, and just to briefly share a little bit about Bernie, he was a lifelong teacher and educator and had been a middle school administrator, I think junior, I mean, vice principal and then principal for many years in the New York City public school system. So just devoted to education and was this is the sweetest, most patient person. He just was beloved person, and it just really feels like a big loss. And one of the when as I was reflecting on it, I sort of felt like there was a way that for me, hearing about Bernie's passing, it was almost like a much younger version of myself was experiencing that, and I've definitely lost, even this year, this difficult year. I think we've all been through so much. And, but the people who in my life who have passed away recently were more like adult relationships. And I think someone like my friend's dad, that really feels like, it just goes deep, of like a kind of childhood loss, or the child is losing, the child in me has lost something, lost someone. And it reminded me of that saying something like, we're not only the age we are now, but we're every age we've ever been. So like it doesn't take much to touch into a much younger version of ourselves and really feel that. And I could imagine losing, I mean, losing a parent, losing a sibling, any of these losses. I mean, they're so, the relationships are so deep, and they go back, they're kind of part of our own architecture of self in a way. And so yeah, just my friend's dad, Bernie, one of the things that I most remember, because I really didn't have much of a relationship with him being in my 20s or 30s or 40s. But one of the things I really remember about him, that he always had a riddle, a joke, or a brain teaser. And I remember being so bored with my friend walking around like the Smithsonian or some, you know, art museum. We were probably like 8 years old. And then we're sitting on a bench with Bernie, and you know, he'd kind of give us another riddle or another, you go work on this one for a while, or another brain teaser. And there was one I remembered, I'm sure, and I just wanted to share it with you because I think it's kind of interesting anyway. And you probably heard it. But it goes like, a man and his son were in a terrible car accident, and they were both brought to the hospital. And the man unfortunately passed away, but the son went into surgery, and then the surgeon stopped and said, "I can't operate on him. He's my son. How could this be?" And I remember, I mean, it was probably like 1984, you know, we were, maybe we were seven or eight. My friend, who was also a boy, and I, we were stumped. We were totally stumped. And, you know, I don't know how, I can't, Alan, but I don't think we came up with the answer. So I wanted to see how my daughters would respond to this. So I told them the riddle. And then they put their hand, they immediately looked at me and they said, "Duh, the surgeon's his mother." And I said, "How did you get that so fast?" And they said, "It's obvious, Dad, come on." And, you know, and I think this is probably the difference of 40 years or something of this collective psyche about gender, right? And, you know, gender bias. So I was interested in this a little bit, and I Googled the riddle, and I saw that in 2014, children still weren't getting it. So I don't know. I don't know what has changed, if something has changed in the, even more, or in the last 7 years. Or the other thing, other idea I had is my children, just one unique thing about how we've raised them so far, it's sort of changing, but is we've been really low media, low screen sort of household. So their school didn't allow screens. They haven't seen TV or movies. They saw a little bit of Mr. Rogers, that the old ones that I showed them before they started at the school and where there was no screen, but they really haven't been exposed to like media and movies and sitcoms. I mean, I just grew up on Three's Company. I don't know, all those sitcoms, remember all that? And, you know, I'd go home, come home from school when I was their age. I'd turn on the TV. I had a little black and white TV in my room. If you remember those? I would turn on the TV with a little rabbit ear antennas, and I would watch TV for about 5 hours, you know, and I do my homework with like one eye on my homework, one eye on the TV. And you know, so they've had a very different upbringing. And I sort of wondered if maybe in a way they haven't gotten some of the cultural messages that, you know, whatever, just get transmitted, but they didn't fall for it at all. They got this right away. But and the other thing I was thinking about my friend's dad, Bernie, was that he made it pretty much intact, definitely mentally. You know, he was doing work and his Holocaust research and all the stuff that he did, pretty, you know, up to age 85. And, you know, I think it's safe to say he never saw the inside of a gym in his life. He didn't smoke or drink much, but besides that, he didn't exercise. He really ate whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted, and they loved food. And so I was thinking to myself, what might account for his relatively good health up to this, you know, most recent kind of thing? And what I just landed on in my own mind, I have no idea if this is true, but was that he was such a relaxed, even-keeled person. I never, and I asked my mom, and she said, I never heard Bernie raise his voice. And, kids sometimes can be really test your patience as much as you love them and as much as you, but that he, and maybe to do the kind of work he did, working with middle schoolers, which I think is also kind of a difficult age, but just that he had this almost like innate sort of equanimity. But it wasn't an equanimity that was detached from the world. It was not cold at all. It was really, warm, engaged, always ready with a joke or always ready with something. My friend's mom, maybe fair to say, is at times could not be the easiest person to she'd kind of be a little demanding, certain, especially in restaurants and just things like that. But Bernie just was sort of the sweetest and just rolled with everything. And I really also got, later in life, not when I was a kid, but I got the sense that I don't think he experienced his wife as difficult. Or maybe he did, but I think he was so in love with her or something that it just didn't matter or something. And I've heard Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you may have heard, the wonderful Supreme Court justice who passed away recently, but she said something like her mother-in-law gave her some advice right after she got married and said something like, in every good marriage, it pays to be a little bit deaf. And I kind of feel like that was Bernie's, just like, hey, he's, if the wife is fighting with the waiter or something, he's, just kind of in his book and not worried about it. So this is a little bit of I just wanted to share a little bit about my friend who, had passed. But it's also a little bit of an introduction to this story I wanted to share, which was one I was just reading and studying today. So I thought it would be nice to share. And it is a Zen story or Zen koan that comes from a collection of these koans called the Blue Cliff Record. And a koan is sometimes translated as a riddle. It's not exactly a riddle, but I guess the famous koans are things like, what is the sound of one hand clapping? Have you heard that? And the thing is, it's not, traditionally koans are worked on not so much by coming up with an answer, or some, thinking about it and coming up with an answer, but it's like you sort of become the koan or you act it out. So the question of what is the sound of one hand clapping might be asking something like, what is the sound of oneness? What does oneness sound like? Is it silence? Is it a shout? Is it, what is it? How do we express oneness? And I think this comes from this school of Buddhism, the Zen school, where it's considered, it's not enough to have some great experience of awakening or some experience of letting go or enlightenment or peace or concentration or stillness. That's good, that's fine. But you really, it's really about living that and enacting it and expressing it. So if you go to a Zen teacher and say, oh, I had this great meditative experience last night or in the last sitting, and he'll say, or she'll say, show it to me right now. Don't tell me about the experience an hour ago. Show it to me right here, right now. And if you're anything like me, it's like, what? Ding, rings the bell, go back and sit. And so there's this kind of flavor of immediacy in Zen. And I appreciate that. I also very much appreciate Vipassana and insight practice and the I think there's a care and a kind of articulateness that in Vipassana we talk about meditation, where in Zen, I think there's often not the language around it is not that precise. And so anyway, so these koans are not so much something to answer, but something to sort of meditate with. And then we have some experience and we bring ourselves to the teacher. And the teacher maybe can recognize that, oh, we've had some insight into this experience of oneness. And so these koans. And this one is the 36th koan. I think there's like 100 in the Blue Cliff record. And then I'll read it, but what it a little bit reminded me of my friend. And so I just wanted to share it. Okay, the 36th case. One day, Master Changsha went roaming in the mountains. When he came back, he was met at the gate by the head monk. He was like the head student, who asked, "Master, where have you been?" Changsha said, "Roaming in the mountains." The head monk asked, "Where did you go?" Master Changsha said, "Starting out, I followed the sweet-smelling herbs. Returning, I chased the falling blossoms." So starting out, I followed the sweet-smelling herbs. Returning, I chased the falling blossoms. The head monk said, "That's the feeling of spring." Changsha said, "Even better than the dew falling on the lotuses in autumn." And that's it. That's the story. The first thing I noticed about this was that they're not fighting with each other. Often in these koans, the student will challenge the teacher, and then the teacher will come right back at the student. And then they're kind of have this little bit of like Dharma combat. And most of the koans are like that present a kind of conflict. And I think that conflict is meant to mirror our own conflict when we come to practice and we're looking for something and we're searching or we're trying to break through something, or we're trying to just figure out suffering, or we're coming to terms with something that's really difficult. So in Zen, they have all these expressions like swallowing the ball of fire, or, you know, you're really wrestling with something. And the teacher, you know, not like the nice Vipassana teachers, you know, like Jack Kornfield or someone who's very kind of supportive and loving. You know, the Zen teachers will smack you and shake you and make you sit and don't move. And really, you know, you come to the teacher with a problem, like, oh, I'm dealing with this difficult suffering or grief or sadness or anger. And the teacher says, okay, I'm going to help you with your problem by giving you a bigger problem. So maybe you'll forget about your problem because I'm going to give you your pain because I'm going to give you something that's even more painful. So it's like, so there's this like built in sort of you're pushing against something. And that's often the way these practices work that you, if you've ever heard of like a very strict meditation monastery or a strict retreat where you can't move, you know, and they say don't move and you're sitting long hours from morning to night. Part of the way those work is that they, and the idea that I think that they don't always work, and often they don't work very well for many people, but the idea is that you kind of are put into this impossible situation. you can't stay because it's so strict and painful, and you can't go, you're kind of stuck. And from that, something that's impossible, at some point the mind lets go. And we realize that it's actually our own mind that's creating the difficulty and the suffering. And so anyway, that's sort of the idea. And so these koans often have some kind of pushing and conflict. And in the commentary about this one, they say, this is really surprising that this one is so sweet and soft, because this master was known for being a really hard guy. And in his younger days, there's a story that he was sort of laying on the ground, standing and looking up at the moon with one of his Dharma nephews. And, you know, this other kind of younger monk who he knew well. And they were kind of admiring the moon. And the younger nephew says something like, everyone has that, but they don't know how to use it. So the moon in the Buddhist imagery is often a symbol for enlightenment, for our true nature. So they're looking up at admiring the full moon, and the younger monk says, everybody has it, but they don't know how to use it. And then so this guy Changsha says, well, why don't you show me how to use it? And then the younger guy says, why don't you show me? And then Changsha, this guy, jumps on him and starts, throws him to the ground and stands on top of him. And the younger guy mutters something like, oh, you use it like a tiger. So, you know, the stories are kind of like this. And then this master had the kind of nickname of being a tiger. But this story, which I quite like, is he says, one day Changsha was roaming in the mountains. And as the commentary says, this is when he was much older, you know, kind of a, you know, in as a mature teacher, practitioner, we could imagine maybe, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s. One day Changsha went roaming in the mountains. When he came back, he was met at the gate by the head monk, who asked, Master, where have you been? Changsha said, roaming in the mountains. The head monk said, where did you go? Changsha said, starting out, I followed the sweet-smelling herbs. Returning, I chased the falling blossoms. And so I think one way of understanding this is that he wasn't, it's describing someone who is not seeking anything. He's not trying to get something. He's not seeking anything. He's wandering, and he's following the nice scent of something. And then chasing the falling blossoms is a very evocative image of, you know, sort of the fleetingness of life, you know, the beauty of blossoms, whose beauty is tied up with its delicacy and its, you know, it's that they're not lasting, you know. And so what do we do as human beings? We chase the falling blossoms. We, you know, so to me, there's something very poignant about, so this is this master who was the tiger, right? You know, he was the one who threw down his younger friend and stomped on him to express his awakening. But here he is roaming around and, you know, smelling the flowers and going after the falling blossoms. And so maybe in a way we could say that this is an image of post-enlightenment practice, of, you know, the idea, you know, is that maybe there's this conflict, we're divided, we're conflicted, but as when we come to Dharma practice, but then in one experience, or maybe over the accumulative lifetime of experiences and practices, practicing and maturation, that we come to a place where we're not so divided anymore. We're not trying to get anything. We're not seeking anything. And so we're just kind of roaming. And I love the image of this master kind of resting in change, resting in the flow of change, you know, to become mature in the practice, or this kind of quote unquote post-enlightenment practice. It doesn't mean that we've transcended change. It doesn't mean that impermanence doesn't apply anymore to us. But that I think this is some kind of image of being in harmony with the world of change and resting in it. But it's not cold. You know, it doesn't imply a kind of cold, detached, yes, there's birth and death, but I don't care. I'm beyond that. It's like, no, he's chasing the falling blossoms. And then it says, so he says, starting out, I follow the sweet smelling herbs. Returning, I chase the falling blossoms. The head monk said, that's the feeling of spring. And Changsha said, even better than the dew falling on the lotuses in autumn. So, you know, what's the difference between spring and autumn? Spring, you know, to me, spring is the season of warmth, right? It's the season of youth. It's the season of opening blossoms and the fragrant air and the, you know, after the rain. And where autumn, maybe he says, even better than the dew falling on the lotuses in autumn. So, you know, autumn is, I think here maybe symbolize, I'm curious what you think, but I think maybe is symbolizing a kind of expression of practice that's a little bit more detached. You know, in autumn, the leaves start to detach, right? And the things get a little darker, the days are darker, it's colder. Autumn, the autumn of our years, you know, is different than the spring of our years. It's kind of a different, it's a different flavor. And here's this great master, this tiger saying, I prefer the spring, you know, better than the dew falling on the lotuses in autumn. So I don't know, there's something very touching to me about this, that he's someone who's had this lifetime of practice, perhaps, and is out, leaves the temple gates and goes for this stroll and, you know, is not troubled by being in this world of change and is even going to allow himself gasp to have some preferences. You know, this is a famous line in Chinese Buddhist teaching that says the great way is not difficult for one who has no preferences. You know, okay. But here he's sort of in harmony. He's not separate from the world of change. And I think there can sometimes be a little bit of a idealization, especially in the Chinese and Japanese Buddhism. I don't know if it's so much in early Buddhist teaching, but definitely in the Chinese Buddhism, there can be a little bit of an idealization of the innocence of childhood and the way children may play, you know, I kind of imagine one of my daughters sort of, you know, just being absorbed in the natural world, playing in the mud and the dirt and the leaves and picking up the leaves or picking dandelions and you know, and have has no, you know, really not much self-consciousness. They're just there playing. And then so I sort of wondered if this is a little, you know, here's an old master, old man who's out in nature. And there's a little bit of a flavor of he's kind of wandering and he's playing and he's, you know, innocent in a sense. But I think it's not the innocence of a child, you know. And I think a big flavor of Dharma practice is it's not so much we all should go back to being a child and being that, having that kind of innocence of a kind of non-conceptual experiencing, but maybe it's more about being natural, you know, being expressing our nature. And for a child, the most natural thing in the world is to be a child and to play and to romp and frolic. But what is natural for a mature person or a mature practitioner who has seen a lot, who's suffered a lot, who's been through a lot in their life, but thanks to their practice, perhaps, they're not weighed down by that. You know, they're still able to be present. And as much as they've seen and they've suffered and they've gone through, they can still appreciate the smells of spring, and they can still, there's this kind of aliveness that, you know, and so I love this. And for me, it's just a great reminder that I think maybe ultimately, all of us are doing this kind of post-enlightenment practice. You know, we don't need to wait until we've been in the most strict monastery and we've been beaten and someone stomped on us and then we had some big opening. And, you know, in any moment that we can value and return to presence, to being present, to this quality of being alive right here, right now, with nothing to seek, with nothing to gain, with nothing to get away from, just being here and sensing into the completeness of this moment, we're there. We're right there with the old masters. And so it's for me, it has that flavor of practice as really foregrounding presence over progress, presence over training, presence over seeking. Because if I'm seeking, I'm looking out there. I'm not really noticing what's here, right? In order to seek, we've got to somehow believe that there's something better than this. And so I think all these old masters and all these teachings are pointing us, no, it's right here. Come back to this. Whatever it is that we're looking for, the only place that we'll find it is here. And like, oh yeah, right. And then it's like, okay, I can be with the sound of the crickets in a different way. I can be with the aches in the body. I can be with the aches in the heart. You know, oh yeah, okay. Yeah, this too is Dharma. This too is our Buddha nature. There's nothing more real than this. There's nothing more profound than this feeling right here, right now. And then it gives whatever ordinary experience we have, I think it gives it this flavor of Dharma, this flavor of the sacred. And it's like, okay. It's right here. And these falling blossoms, you know, maybe the child in us might grab the flowers, grab the blossoms. And that's what a child does, you know? And maybe we might just catch them, you know, we see, and we can catch it in our hands. And, oh yeah, appreciate this. And so maybe I'll stop here. And just wish for each of us that we give this great gift to ourselves of presence and honoring who and what we already are, you know, what we already have. It's so, I think it's so much in our nature to look past this for something over there. And we'll do that. We'll keep doing that. But maybe we can also honor that. You know, there's something even in that seeking, even in that longing, that's a feeling. That's something that can be felt and open to and honored in a way. It's a great gift to ourselves. Thank you very much.